Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in moments, C.J. Chacko will tell us about quasi-fascism in the Philippines. And then at the bottom of the hour, Jonah Birch will talk about working-class rebellion in France. My first guest is C.J. Chacko, a geographer at the University of the Philippines, and author of a couple of pieces on the Jacobin magazine website on political developments in that country. On May 9th, Filipinos elected Rodrigo Duterte, the longtime mayor of the second-largest city in the country, Davao City, to succeed Benigno Aquino III. Duterte, who takes office on June 30th, is a hard-to-classify populist, who's run death squads that have been responsible for the deaths of over 1,000 people, allegedly criminals. Curiously, he has the support of the largest left organization in the country, the Communist Party, or CPP, whose New People's Army has been running a Maoist-style revolution since the 1960s. What's it all about? Here's C.J. Chacko to tell us. Welcome, C.J. You've got a new president coming into office very soon. Tell us about Rodrigo Duterte.
Well, Rodrigo Duterte is used to be the mayor of Davao City. He was a mayor of Davao City, which is in the south, the island of Mindanao. And he's been the mayor there for like over 20 years. If you've been hearing the news in the international media, like Duterte has often been compared to Donald Trump. And in some ways, there's a striking resemblance. Like he's, throughout this campaign, he's been issuing all of these outrageous statements. So he's also a bit of an enigma because Duterte comes from a part of the country where the politics in the Philippines is really like it's patrimonial, it's clientelistic, and the politics in Mindanao is perhaps like the fullest expression of that. When he emerged in the national political scene, it was in a way a bit of a surprise for the other presidential candidates. At first, he was treated as something of a clown. Like, a lot of the other candidates didn't think he would have a chance of actually winning the presidency because he was issuing all of these outrageous statements that, you know, conventional politicians weren't really, you know, weren't able to match in a way. And because of his bombastic character, eventually, during the later stages of the presidential campaigns, people started realizing that, oh, this is a man who actually has a chance of winning the presidency. And then we saw the way he was able to really bend. Like he would issue different political statements to different audiences, and it was hard for the left really to get a sense of which part of the political spectrum he actually stands on, because when he's in front of trade union groups and civil society groups, he would say one thing, and then when he's in front of, like, for example, the Philippine Chambers of Commerce and these big business groups, he would say things in their favor. So it's hard to get a sense of where he stands on the political spectrum. And then when he managed to win the candidacy, the people he chose to be part of his cabinet, a lot of those people were people associated with the former Gloria Macapagal Arroyo administration, who was the president before the current Aquino administration. And so a lot of the mainstream analysts were saying that, you know, Duterte is this expression of people's frustration at the Aquino administration, which would probably come as a surprise to an international audience, because I'm sure in the media in the United States or in Europe, like, when you hear of the Philippines, you hear of all of these political reforms, economic growth and progress that has been going on in the Philippines under the Aquino administration. But in reality, it's actually a different picture, because these past 6 years under the Aquino administration, while there was, like, you know, all of this news of this economic growth, political reforms, you know, less corruption, etc., apparently a lot of people, you know, the majority of the Filipino population haven't really felt that progress. And so a lot of people were saying that maybe, you know, Duterte is kind of the antithesis of the Aquino administration's slogans of being like this matuwid na daan, this good governance platform. And Duterte was, because of his demeanor and his all of these bombastic, politically incorrect way of running his campaign, that he was standing as the antithesis of the Aquino administration. At the moment, it's hard to tell what Duterte is?
One of the things I think that people are frightened of, at least from this distance, are that he's talked about ridding the nation of undesirables, of summary executions, death squads. How bad is that? Is this for real?
So all the statements about extrajudicial killings and human rights violations, actually, the Davao Death Squad has been around also for around 2 decades. Like I mentioned before, Mindanao is this place where actually impunity, if you think about impunity in the context of Philippine politics, it gets really bad in the southern Philippines, in Mindanao, where Duterte comes from. And actually, there is a lot of truth to the rumors that, for example, the Davao Death Squad is responsible for the extrajudicial killings of like over 1,000 civilians, many of them minors and street children and drug addicts. So Duterte actually built his platform on this anti-crime, anti-drugs crusade. And a lot of people bought into that because if you try to study like the situation of the urban poor, crime and drugs, narco-politics is actually a big thing among like the working class communities. And, you know, this platform of fear and anti-crime and anti-drugs was really patok, which is a Filipino word for, was really popular for not just, you know, the middle class who was really into the anti-crime crusade, but also for the working classes who have been the primary targets of this anti-drug, anti small crime crusade that Duterte represents.
And is this some sort of classic sense that you know, working class people feel a sense of disorder and chaos and insecurity, and they look to him as a principle of order who'll straighten things out?
Yeah, in a way, but you know, when you look at Duterte's base of political support, it really cuts across classes. For the upper middle class in places like Metro Manila, you know, Duterte represents, again, the antithesis of Aquino in the sense that he promises a quick fix for everything. For example, the traffic in Manila is really bad, and, you know, the inefficiencies of the Aquino administration, the perceived inefficiencies of the Aquino administration, for example, with regard to dealing with traffic in Metro Manila or dealing with natural disasters like Typhoon Haiyan, you know, what happened after Typhoon Haiyan, all of these perceived inefficiencies of the Aquino administration was seen by the middle class, the upper middle class, as something that Duterte would be able to deal with, because, you know, Duterte projects this image of being, you know, a no-nonsense figure. But with the lower and the lower in the working classes, really, Duterte stands as somebody from Mindanao who is as a provinciano or somebody from the provinces, from the rural poor. And so when he came to the national stage, he was seen as somebody who would represent the masses in that way, that here was somebody from Mindanao, which is like one of the poorest regions of the Philippines, and he will come here to really represent the interests of the poor. And in that sense, he is a bit like the Joseph Estrada administration, which came to power in the early 2000s. But the difference with Estrada was that Estrada came on this like anti-poor populist platform. But the difference now is that Duterte really came explicitly on this like authoritarian platform. Like, for example, for the middle class, they see Duterte as something of a Lee Kuan Yew figure. Like, there were all of these campaign slogans about him being this benevolent dictator. So you have this sentiment of him, this urge for a return to martial law, to the decades of authoritarian rule, as something that would fix some of the problems of, you know, the current political system. And so, for example, you have a lot of people saying that Duterte also represents like people's frustrations at the failures of, you know, the post-Marcos, post-martial law, post-dictatorship administrations, in the sense that, you know, Philippine democracy, like Philippine liberal democracy, has failed, which is something that I tried to point out in the two articles that I wrote for Jacobin. Like, Duterte's rise is really a factor of some of the contradictions of Philippine democracy.
Let's talk some about the CPP. He's got the support of the Maoist Communist Party of the Philippines and its affiliate, the New People's Army. What's that all about? Why do they support him?
Well, actually, what's clear is that like the CPP is by no means united on Duterte. So, for example, the CPP, you know, its front organizations during the election campaign, they actually leaned toward Grace Poe, who was like another presidential candidate. While Joe Macizo, the party's, you know, official chairman and spokesperson, has always spoken favorably of Duterte. The CPP has a long relationship. For example, its Southern Mindanao Regional Command, which is like its mass organizations in Mindanao, have long had like a working relationship with Duterte in Davao. So if you look at some of their political campaigns in Davao, for example, with regard to land reform, indigenous people's rights, etc., they've actually developed a working relationship with Duterte. Because what's unique about Duterte is that he's able to, because the CPP has its armed wing, which is the New People's Army, so its strategy is still like this protracted people's war, this Maoist protracted people's war. And in Davao, in the Davao region, in Mindanao, they're particularly strong. So a lot of their NPA, their armed wing, their forces are concentrated in Mindanao. And Duterte was somebody who was able to play the middleman between the Philippine government, the army, and the NPA. So he has friends in the military, he has friends in the NPA. So whenever there were disputes, for example, the NPA would target large-scale mining corporations to extract what they call a revolutionary tax. So, for example, when there are these incidents that take place, Duterte steps in and then tries to intervene, and then he's able to negotiate between these right-wing forces and the CPP left. Some of the individuals known to be linked to the CPP actually campaigned for Duterte during his presidential campaign. And it's very contradictory because Duterte is also a member of a political dynasty, because you know, Philippine politics is defined by these families that control different parts of the country. So you have this political class who are divided between the provinces and the central government. So, for example, in Mindanao, we have all of these political dynasties who are associated with different parts of Mindanao. And the Duterte family and the Danao clan, who is like related to Duterte, they're particularly powerful in the Davao region. And so Duterte is actually an elite figure in that sense. Since he's been there for so long and he's cultivated this relationship with the CPP thinks, you know, with Duterte in charge and with Duterte's history of being favorable to some of their organizations at certain points in time, they think that this is a chance for them to really succeed in their peace process, which didn't succeed under the Aquino administration. Whether they admit it or not, the Maoist armed strategy, their protracted people's war, as I mentioned, is really not working, and they see Duterte as an opportunity to restore their political relevance in a way. So you see Joma Season and all of these big party leaders really gravitating toward Duterte. But then there are some factions of the CPP who disagree, especially the mass organizations in Manila, who as I said, were leaning more toward Grace Poe. So really, the party is divided in that sense.
I'm speaking with C.J. Chanco, who is a geographer at the University of the Philippines. I want to talk some about the class structure of the Philippines. Let's start at the top. It seems like the elites that I've read about in your pieces in Jacobin are somewhat split by region and interest group. Is there anything like a coherent ruling class that we would think of?
Yes, definitely, because our political elites, who are the people who are in government, for example, they're divided between, as I mentioned, they're divided between the regional elites. So, for example, if you've read works by certain anthropologists, they say that, you know, the Philippine politics, the Philippine state is really controlled by an anarchy of families, in the sense that these families have been in control of the government since the time of the American administration, way through the martial law period and up to the present. So these families, for example, if you look at the composition of Congress, a lot of those representatives from the provinces really hail from the landed elite. A lot of the relatives of these congressmen are really big landowners in the provinces, in the rural areas. But when you look at the composition of our economic elites, for example, our businessmen and the business class, and with regard to their relationship with Duterte, the structure of the country's political economy. So, for example, in these past 6 years, there's been all of this news of economic growth and economic development in the Philippines, but it's really been in, for example, in real estate, in construction, in speculative sectors, in the financial sector, because these are economic elites that were part of the landed class who have been transitioning in recent years toward real estate. For example, they've been converting some of their lands from agriculture to commercial. So there's this layer of, you would call them the bourgeoisie or the new capitalist class, who have really benefited tremendously from the country's integration with global capital. But we used to have a strong industrial class, which was decimated in the 1990s. So, for example, we had strong industries in the 1980s and the 1990s, even during martial law. And those were all decimated. So what we have now is really like our economic class is really divided between these economic elites who benefit enormously from their connections with the government. If you have a political class which is associated with these different big families, you also have your bourgeoisie who are affiliated with these big families. For example, you have the Ayala family, the Consunji family, you have the Manny V. Pangilinans, you have the Enrique Razon. So you have these different old and new elites who are organized almost into families. The sector of the bourgeoisie has benefited most from the economic growth from these past 6 years have been those who have supported the Aquino administration. So for every administration, for every presidential administration that comes to power, you have these particular economic elites who gravitate toward them, and that's how they extract their profits. A lot of businessmen, they would have these contracts with the government called public-private partnerships, which I also mentioned in the article. And this is really a major way for them to extract their profits because they don't really have a good market for their products in the Philippines because wages are so low and unemployment is so high. So the chief mechanism for them to get their profits is really through government contracts and through their relationships with the state. And then you also have, for example, the elites who were, you know, that layer of the capitalist class who were really supporting Duterte. They came from Mindanao, so you have these small and medium businessmen, especially the Davao elites. So we have the local political clans in Mindanao who came rushing in support of Duterte. And you also have some of the elites from Manila who again saw Duterte as a strongman figure, almost a Marcos for two, who would be able to restore order or their idea of order in Metro Manila. So, yeah, different sections of the ruling class and also different sections of the working class who are supporting Duterte for different reasons.
What about that working class then? What does that consist of? The Philippines, how industrialized is it? How large is the industrial working class? And are they organized in any meaningful way?
As I mentioned, like, for example, the bulk of our working class, if you even consider it as a working class, is really, a lot of them are really in the informal sector. So you have like the semi, yeah, first of all, you have, you know, three layers of the working class. So you have the first layer, which is still your industrial core. You have formal workers who still work in factories, who have relatively decent wages and who are, you know, permanent employees of these industries. You also have workers who are benefiting from the growth in the BPO sector, which is the call center industry, especially here in Metro Manila. But though that layer of the working class is really a small, really a minority of, you know, the bulk of the working class, which is really, you would call it like this semi-proletarian or precariat labor force. Who, for example, if you look at the context of Mindanao, a lot of them are also farmers. So you have people shuttling between the cities and the rural areas. They don't have permanent jobs.
What do you expect from his presidency? I mean, is we going to see a period of authoritarianism, crackdowns on freedom of expression and union organizing, or some kind of incoherent, drifting policy? What do you expect it's going to look like under Duterte?
You know, it's really difficult to make out. You know, again, as I mentioned, it's hard to know where he stands and what he really stands for. For example, you have his entire cabinet is really like a parliament of sorts. You have all of these right-wing hawks, and you also have, you know, maybe token representation from members of the CPP, for example, who were placed in the Department of Labor and the Department of Agrarian Reform. But it's unclear, you know, what kind of change they'll be able to make, you know, even with these cabinet positions. And in the absence of really a strong, like, independent labor movement, as I mentioned, it's hard to see, you know, whether there is any possibility of swaying him in a more progressive direction. Because at the moment, you see that months after, you know, weeks after he was elected, he released this 10-point economic agenda, which was really no different from that of his predecessor. So you have this basic set of neoliberal reforms. And it's really surprising that, you know, you have sections of the left, you know, not just the CPP, who have illusions that Duterte would be, at the very least, like a left-wing populist figure along the lines of Hugo Chavez, which is really, when you look at his statements, as far as his statements are concerned, it's nothing like Hugo Chavez. So it's really, you know, even the left at the moment, the organized left, is unclear at this point, you know, what Duterte really stands for. And the tragedy now is, like, the association between Duterte and the left, and the CPP left, will be hard to break, given that he's associated himself. You know, when people speak of the left these days, people actually associate the left with Duterte and, you know, what he stands for. And so you have this question whether that narrative somebody will be able to change that narrative in the years ahead. And in the absence, again, of an alternative political movement which will be able to really push him in a different direction, you know, it's likely that we'll be entering a period of, you know, crackdowns on human rights, an economic agenda that, you know, Duterte would be a figure who would project this image, this populist image, at the same time that he allows the neoliberal technocrats, the economists, the so-called experts, to really run the economy. So on one hand, you have this, like, populist face, while the political regime stays intact. So actually, Duterte is something of really a win for the ruling class in that sense, because he's now able to really silence opposition, because, you know, considering how the CPP is now gravitating toward him, and a lot of other rebel groups in Mindanao, you know, separatist Muslim groups are also gravitating toward Duterte. So essentially, he has no real meaningful opposition.
That was C.J. Chenko, a geographer at the University of the Philippines in Manila. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was the first movement of the third piano sonata by Pierre Boulez, performed by Peace Shen Chen. Next, France. France has been the scene of large demonstrations over the last few weeks, protesting a neoliberal reform of the country's labor law being pushed by the nominally socialist president François Hollande. The presidents grew out of nightly assemblies in the Place de la République in Paris that began in March, a movement called Nuit Debout. Debout, arise, is the first word of the French version of the Internationale. These occupations of the Place de la République were protesting the labor law and the policies it represented. These have now grown into large daytime affairs. Here's Jonah Birch, a grad student at NYU whose specialty is French labor law, to tell us all.
Welcome, Jonah. So why are there so many French people on the streets?
Force of habit. The government is trying to push through this labor law bill that would significantly weaken the labor code in a whole bunch of ways, which we can get into. But this is really, it's the culmination of a whole process of a campaign by the Hollande government since Hollande's election in 2012, and which has really accelerated in recent years, to weaken labor law, to flexibilize and liberalize, employment regulations in France. And at a time in which there's very high rates of unemployment, there's a lot of social tension, a lot of anger, this has really set people off. And the government has handled this, even from their own perspective, very poorly, I think. But at this point, they're facing majority opposition to their labor law proposal, and a movement that has not only majority support, but very strong, active presence in the streets, led by the sort of the struggle-oriented wing of the French labor movement.
Hollande is extremely unpopular at this point, right?
Historically unpopular, yes. In the latest polls I saw, his approval rating was 14%, and his prime minister, Manuel Valls, was just a little bit above that.
And now, of course, Hollande is nominally a socialist or a social democrat, but he comes from that kind of neoliberal wing of European social democracy, right? Situate him politically for us.
It's important to be clear that when he was elected in 2012, it was not on the basis of we are going to implement these sort of drastic austerity policies and this major liberalization of French employment law. Certainly there are elements of that there, but I think he's gone much farther than anyone is expected, and definitely his base. And he's really opened up some very significant rifts within the Socialist Party. And in some ways, the face of his administration is now Valls, his prime minister, who he has appointed, who's much more sort of aggressive, considered more of a hardliner. And they appointed as the finance minister, Emmanuel Macron, who is a former investment banker, a real technocrat in the European mold, a neoliberal technocrat, very close to business. Hollande, in fact, was elected on the basis of being sort of the anti-Nicolas Sarkozy, his predecessor as president of France. And he, a lot of people consider what he's done since being elected a betrayal, of the sort of traditions of the Socialist Party. And it's clear that, yes, he sees himself as playing that kind of role of a Schroeder, of the sort of neoliberal social democratic modernizer. That wasn't the basis on which he came to power.
You know, Schroeder, of course, one of the stalwarts of the third way of the 90s, who helped create a low-wage, or pretty much created a low-wage labor market in Germany, right? Hollande has professed admiration for him.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he's several times professed admiration for him. And I think inside the government, and in general in the right wing of the Socialist Party, and you see it all the time in the media, there's a lot of people who see the sort of German model as the way to go in France and see Germany as sort of the successful case of modernization, the move towards more flexible labor markets with everything that entails. And they see France as something of a laggard. And Hollande sees his role as pushing France down that road. There are some electoral considerations that have gone into what the government has tried to do, and there's an election coming up next year, 2017. And I think there is a degree to which the government has sort of tried to, it's seen its strategy as splitting the right and trying to get through the first round of the elections, the presidential election next year, to get into the runoff with the far right, the National Front. Marine Le Pen has been leading in the polls. She's been at the top of the polls for the presidential election for a while now. So the government would like to get into the runoff with the far right and sort of present itself as the only alternative to the far right. To the extent there is an electoral strategy there, it's been a disastrous one. And in fact, Hollande currently, in some polls, is behind even the more left candidate next year, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, in the first round of voting. So it doesn't look like this has sort of paid off.
So what is this labor law? What are the details they're trying to change?
There's a whole bunch of things that the labor law will do, and it'll further undermine the 35-hour work week and allow employers to force their workers to work more overtime with a smaller overtime bonus. It'll make it much easier for employers to lay off workers for a whole variety of reasons, and will reduce the amount of compensation that laid off workers are able to get through the French labor courts. I think the biggest thing that the law would do was that it would increase the space for employers to sign company level agreements with both union and non-union employee representatives that would undermine the terms of both the labor laws and the traditional collective bargaining agreements, which have traditionally been negotiated at the sectoral level. So this whole thing about the sort of rise of company level agreements and the way that implies a decentralization of the industrial relations system of collective bargaining. You know, I think a lot of people see that as a way of trying to undermine employment standards around everything from wages to hours and working conditions through this kind of decentralization, through this strategy of a turn towards localized bargaining. And that really has been a central point of contention in the battle over the reform law. People talk about it as reversing the hierarchy of norms. So traditionally, you know, employment was regulated from labor law down through the sectoral collective bargaining system, and then really in recent decades down into these company level agreements. But those were always restricted in scope by labor law, by the sectoral level bargaining. This would sort of reverse that. The locus, the center of collective bargaining, would move towards the company level, and really all over Europe in recent years, that kind of decentralization of bargaining has been a way for employers to wrest concessions from labor, from workers, by shifting the basis for bargaining onto a terrain that's more favorable to them.
Now, as I recall, while French union density is not that high, the share of the workforce that belongs to unions, a very large portion of the labor force is covered by union contracts nonetheless, right? There's this pattern bargaining arrangement that now is under attack.
Yeah, I mean, it's a system that's very hard for Americans to understand because it's very different than ours. You know, at the same time, you don't have to be a member of a union to be covered by a collective bargaining agreement. So you're absolutely right. Actually, union density, union membership levels are even lower than in the United States. But the percentage of the workforce that's covered by collective bargaining agreements is well over 90%. And then on the other hand, multiple unions can be represented within a given workplace. You have this fragmentation of the French trade union movement, which is really divided on a whole bunch of lines. And sometimes you see that even within the same workplace, but really you can break that down into these kind of two wings, the sort of struggle-oriented wing, which is led by the CGT. Historically, it used to be a communist-aligned union. It's sort of the more left, the more militant of the two big trade union confederations. And then on the other hand, there is the more moderate cooperative wing, which is led by a union called the CFDT, which has in recent years negotiated agreements with Hollande and over a whole bunch of really, really concessionary, you know, really pretty destructive reforms of employment and of labor law. And the CFDT really has seen its role as pushing towards a sort of modern, cooperative, non-confrontational, social democratic trade unionism, as opposed to the CGT, and sort of it's trying to position itself as kind of the favored bargaining partner of the government. And I think in some ways, you know, has been pretty successful in a lot of ways up until this point, when the government has just gone too far and it's really, things have really exploded on the streets.
Bob Fitch used to argue that that French model of having multiple unions competing for the favor of the working class was actually a good thing. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are strengths and there are weaknesses to that. I mean, just to say, I think there's a mythology in the United States that workers in France are on strike all the time, that unions are constantly in conflict with employers and with the governments. And actually, you've seen this real collapse in strike rates since the 1970s. In the last 5 years, they've been at like a 100-year low. So there's been very low level of of workplace strike activity in France. And meanwhile, union density has gone way, way down, particularly like the CGT's membership fell by over half during the 1980s. And that really has undermined workers' power at the shop floor. On the other hand, particularly around these political conflicts over everything from pension reform to employment contracts over the last couple of decades, you have seen this pattern whereby, you know, at times the CFDT has been punished for its conservatism, for its hesitancy to confront the government, and definitely there is a real sense that you have to be able to effectively, let's say, represent the demands of labor as a whole. And there is that kind of competition between trade unions in France, which is, you know, which obviously you certainly don't see in the United States, but you also don't see in traditionally like more social democratic economies in Europe, including ones that historically had much lower levels of inequality than France did.
Is the Communist Party a political factor at all?
Yes and no. I mean, so the Communist Party has lost a lot of its strength since the 1980s. It's really, it's much weaker than it used to be. It doesn't have the same kind of base. It does have some positions still, elected positions, probably more than anyone else to the left of the, well, definitely more than anyone else to the left of the Socialist Party. But it really is just it's a shell of what it once was. And there have been a lot of tensions over, I think even internally, over its political strategy in recent years. Now, since in the last half decade, it has been in, a little bit more than that, it's been an alliance with the left party of Jean-Luc Mélenchon in something called the Front de Gauche, the Left Front. And Mélenchon was kind of the candidate of the far left in the 2012 presidential elections. He got a little over 11% of the vote. In recent years, the tensions internally between the left party and the Communist Party have really reached a kind of boiling point, to the point where the left front, it's not functioning anymore. I mean, it doesn't really exist as an alliance. And there's a question about whether, you know, the communists could run or support an alternative candidate to Mélenchon in 2017, which, you know, I don't know how far that could go. But it's played this role in the Front de Gauche, and now the Front de Gauche is kind of dead. And so it's not quite clear what anyone on the left is going to do next. There's been actually, I would say, in the last couple of years, a real crisis of the French left, you know, which has been in decline in a lot of ways for quite a while. And that's kind of reached a peak in recent years.
I'm speaking with Jonah Birch, who is a graduate student at NYU studying French labor law and also a contributing editor of Jacobin magazine. But now there's still some socialist opposition within the Socialist Party to Hollande's neoliberalism, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I mean, so there is a left of the Socialist Party still. There is a group of kind of dissident parliamentary delegates known as the Frondeurs, it's like the rebels, basically. And they've opposed a whole series of measures that the government has tried to push through around reforming labor law and some of its austerity measures. They have been really pretty marginal inside the Socialist Party over the last couple of years. Now, because the government is going so far and it's really pushing so hard, that kind of opposition has spread to more leading elements within the Socialist Party. So the fissures are more clear. Whether that will lead to anything in terms of a break, you know, I'm not so sure. But definitely, you've seen a spread of that kind of opposition.
Now, with the left either weak or neoliberal, I imagine a lot of working class voters are looking to Le Pen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so you know, the FN is a real threat. It's a growing force in the regional elections. At the end of last year, it got about a quarter of the vote nationally. Marine Le Pen, from the polls I've seen, if the elections were right now, she would finish ahead of everyone except potentially one possible candidate of the right, a guy named Alain Juppé, actually a former prime minister who saw his own pension reform proposal defeated by mass public sector strikes in December of 1995. And he's back now, and he is in the same party as Sarkozy, the former president, and they're kind of competing to be the candidate of the mainstream center-right. And Juppé is positioning himself as a bit more of a centrist candidate right now, a little bit more moderate than Sarkozy. And he is the only candidate who would come out ahead of Marine Le Pen, the head of the Front National, if the election were right now. Marine Le Pen is very clever in a lot of ways. They've been put in a complicated position by this movement because on the one hand, they want to denounce the left, denounce the trade unions, denounce the movement. And they were really quite violent, as they often are, in their language about the Nuit Debout encampment protests that we saw this spring and about the movement in general. And then on the other hand, they're trying to appeal, exactly as you say, to working class voters and be sort of the position themselves as the real opposition to the government and to its austerity drive. And so you could say their attitude has sort of been like neither the movement nor the law. But today, when the government tried to ban these protests for the protest that the unions had called for June 23rd, Marine Le Pen denounced the government, even though just a month ago she herself had called for banning demonstrations. And so, you know, she's really trying to play both sides of the aisle on this one.
Well, she purged her own father for being too much of a Nazi, right?
She did, yeah. I mean, her whole strategy has been to normalize the far right, the FN, by ditching the language of traditional fascism and really focusing on hostility to Muslims, to immigrants, Muslims in particular, and to the EU. You know, and so the kind of more open anti-Semitism and the Holocaust revisionism that Jean-Marie Le Pen was known for, some of the conspiracy theories, she's tried to distance herself from that. So I think there's a lot of tensions within that family. I mean, also between her and her niece, who is a young leader of the FN in the south of France. You know, there are real tensions within that family. I wouldn't want to be at their Thanksgiving dinner.
So who is coming into the streets? How broad are the demonstrations? And what precisely is their agenda? Is it like a very specifically targeted to the labor belt law, or is this part of a whole, you know, parcel of demands?
That's a really good question. The immediate cause that is bringing people out into the streets is definitely the labor law. And the central slogan of the CGT and some of its close allies has been withdrawal of the labor law. That's the demand. The head of the CGT, who is a more left-wing labor leader, the CGT actually had an internal crisis last year and the year before, and out of it emerged a more left-led leadership, headed by this guy, Philippe Martinez, who was, I think, a longtime Communist Party member and certainly is on the left. They are demanding the withdrawal of the labor law. They have signaled some willingness to negotiate with the government, not over the core provisions, but over, it has, they say the core of the law needs to go, but maybe some things on the edges. The government is not willing to budge on that. The CGT has also put forward a kind of broader vision of how to change French labor law, change the structure of employment in a way that would be more conducive to workers' interests, to a more egalitarian economic agenda. So, for example, you know, one of the things that the government is arguing is we have 10% unemployment, 25% youth unemployment. Actually, unofficial unemployment is much higher than that, lots and lots of long-term unemployment. We need to do all these reforms in order to kickstart employment growth and get people back to work. And I think a lot of people have really questioned that, and they look at the reform bill and they say, you know, how is allowing employers to work their current employees longer and harder and to lay them off more easily, how is that going to increase the number of jobs out there? I think people are really skeptical about that. An alternative that the CGT has put forward is a further reduction of the standard work week from 35 to 32 hours. And, you know, Martinez argues if that happened with, you know, when they got rid of the loopholes in the 35-hour work week, that it would create 4.5 million new jobs. Now, whether or not that figure is right, it's certainly something that is really worth thinking about, and there's something very important there in what they're putting forward. Other people who have been involved in the protest movement, some other groups, and there's a wide range of groups that have been involved. you know, are not necessarily as left or would be more willing to negotiate or cooperate if the government was willing to make some big concessions, but it doesn't appear that it is willing to. The movement itself has been, you know, it's brought out a very wide, very diverse array of people, is my sense. There were big protests of high school and university students earlier in the spring. There was lots of people who were involved in these Nuit Debout encampments that are not part of the labor movement per se, and in fact, you know, I think many people had some real questions about the role of the labor movement or whether having labor be more centrally involved was something that was even desirable. But right now, things have really taken off over the last few weeks, and you've seen an increase in strike activity. There is still an issue about expanding the movement beyond some of the bastions, the traditional bastions of the labor movement. And there's a question about intensifying the strikes and increasing the pressure on the government about how to do that, about whether that's possible right now. These protests are actually not as big necessarily. In fact, they're certainly smaller than some of the big demonstrations that happened in the fall of 2010 that targeted Sarkozy's pension reform. But that movement was defeated in part because you didn't see that shift towards strikes, towards workplace mobilizations, and you're seeing more of that now. How to build on that, how to continue it, I think is a real question at this point.
And finally, France is under a state of emergency after those terrorist attacks. When I was in Paris last summer, before the intensification of the state of emergency, I was amazed by the number of cops with automatic weapons I saw all over town. How does this state of emergency figure into these protests?
Let me say that in general, I don't think anyone quite expected this kind of social explosion. In fact, a lot of people who I've talked to were convinced that labor, that the working class, the left, was no longer capable of pulling something like this off. And I think there was a real sense after the attacks of last November that it was going to be very hard to fight the government as it continued to try and ram labor law reform and austerity down everyone's throats. The fact that has not been the case is really amazing. And a lot of these protests, there's been a lot of violence on them. There's been a very heavy police presence. I think there's some questions about the tactics of the movement, of the protests, that a lot of people have been debating. The police presence has been really remarkable. I mean, there have been a series of incidents at demonstrations that have raised questions about the level of police brutality. And just to say, you know, the French police, I think people in the U.S. think of European cops as being nicer and a little bit friendlier, more liberal than American cops. There's a lot fewer of them in France, and, you know, you don't see the kind of regular killings that you see here. But the French police have a long history of being very, very brutal. You've seen a real escalation of that, I think, during these protests. On the other hand, it's also meant that the question of democracy has become a central one and has been a key one in the protests themselves. One of the things that keeps coming up is that because the reform bill is so unpopular and the government faces such opposition from the left on the one hand and then on the right, they want more. They don't think it goes far enough, the current reform bill, and the employers think that as well. The government has been forced to resort to this constitutional provision, the 49-3, which allows them essentially to bypass parliamentary vote. You know, and that's how they pushed through an earlier labor law reform that was also contentious last year, the Loi Macron. That's how they got the first reading of the current bill, the El Khomri law, through the National Assembly. Now it goes to the Senate. It's going to come back to the National Assembly. This question of democracy, I think, is really a central one. And I think that the protest movement in the context of this crackdown is leading to a pretty general political crisis. I mean, in some ways, we saw it just today. The government tried to effectively force this demonstration on the 23rd just to be a kind of like a standing protest without any march. The outcry was so intense and so widespread, they were forced to back down on that pretty quickly. And so in some ways, the repression is backfiring in a certain way. We'll see how far that goes. Definitely, you know, the government is trying to discredit the protest movement as violent, as not thinking about the concerns that people have in the context of terrorist attacks and yada yada yada. That hasn't stopped the protests so far. We'll see how far that can go going forward.
That was Jonah Birch, a grad student at NYU and contributing editor to Jacobin magazine. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, a bit of the Internationale performed by Alistair Hewlett. Till next week, bye.
Arise, ye works from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last vital FSS. The Internationale unites the human race. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last vital FSS. The Internationale unites the human race.